Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Offensive Donald Davey. Let's get into the news of today. And the first thing we're going to be talking about is a petition by advocacy organization Free SA, which has launched a campaign calling for a constitutional change that would limit the size of cabinet and place restrictions on the president's ability to determine the size of the executive. Free SA argues that the current constitution allows the president, quote, excessive discretion to expand the executive at taxpayers' expense. They say that this is part of a broader constitutional review. They propose to amend the constitution to limit the number of cabinet ministers to no more than 20. Currently, the rules basically allow the president to appoint any number of ministers from among members of parliament. And they say this creates the potential for unnecessary cabinet expansion and political patronage. The campaign was launched after President Ramaphosa announced salary increases for ministers, deputy ministers, and MPs. Ministers now earn about 2.79 million rand a year, and ordinary MPs 1.3 million rand a year. A number of other groups have supported this. SAFTU, the Center for Development and Enterprise, the Free Market Foundation have all suggested that South Africa's cabinet, which is one of the biggest in the world, should be reduced. Spokesman for Free SA, Gideon Joubert, said, South Africans deserve a government that is focused on service delivery, not political accommodation. An unlimited cabinet creates opportunities for wasteful expansion and weakens accountability. A constitutional cap would help ensure that future governments remain lean, efficient, and focused on delivering results for citizens. Joubert said that a small executive would strengthen governments by clarifying ministerial responsibilities, reducing duplication between departments, and improving public oversight of government performance. Let me start off by playing a bit of devil's advocate here and taking the unpopular view. This is something that I very much directionally feel is correct. But I do wonder whether this is the right place to target reforms. And let me explain why. There are obvious drawbacks to having a very large cabinet, and we can see it right now in government, the fact that Ramaphosa created these millions of deputy ministers to make sure that the DA would not really be able to outnumber the ANC or have significant influence in many ministries, because every DA deputy is matched by an ANC deputy. But at the same time, I can see a world where future coalition governments, especially when you look at our electoral system and how it encourages even quite small parties to basically play a role in coalitions, that we might need basically forms of political patronage to hold together coalition governments in the future. And that could mean creating not super necessary political patronage positions in government. Now, is that good in terms of direct value for money? No, but it can help to create a sense of political stability. The other thing, is that the real bloat and fat in government is not at the ministers, it's not at the MPs. There are 400 MPs, and while there's a lot of ministers, there's not nearly that many. The real problem is that we have this enormous legion of civil servants, some of whom earn much more than MPs, who don't provide any applicable kind of real value for service. And they are entrenched in the bureaucracy, and they are often protected by public sector wage unions and big wage bargaining agreements. And that's where the real cost of government, that's where we're spending this huge chunk of salaries on. And that taking away more benefits from the top end of the scale, the ministers and MPs, the political oversight, will just mean that less talented and exceptional people will get into those positions because they can make more money in business. Anyway, unpopular opinions there, but your thoughts on this call for a constitutional change?
Yeah, sure. So I'll first touch on the constitutionality of the conversation, which is that It's kind of, I think it's definitely warranted, considering that the president has the powers to have as big of a cabinet as he wants. So I think there wouldn't be a harm in creating a kind of a cap, especially considering that there is a cap into how few cabinet positions you can have. According to the Constitution, some departments are ought to be there. So the president can't scrap DIRCO, the Department of International Relations, or Defense or Finance, because the Constitution mandates those to exist. So at the in terms of having few cabinet positions, the Constitution already has set that cap. So now it's about the limit of it. And I think it's worth a discussion, and it's also worth a parliamentary debate on. It ought to be a conversation that should have started a while ago, but there was no reason to start the conversation a while ago because the coalition politics of it had not come into effect before we knew that after an election, all the ministries will be held by the ANC so they can do whatever they want. And it wasn't such a big concern. And only after the GNU, we saw extra positions being added so that enough ANC members can hold cabinet positions, and that despite not distributing cabinet positions distributively or equally around all the members of the GNU. The DA was given six positions, but when looking at the percentages in terms of the number of ministries there are in cabinet, it deserves about 13 or 14 ministries. So the DA already lost that negotiation battle, and the ANC wrongfully took the DA spots while also adding more spots. We can all agree that's not a good thing, and the Constitution being able to set some sort of a cap would help to regulate that. It would also help to strengthen coalition negotiations because we're going to have a whole lot more of those in the future. And speaking to your point, I understand what you say about that they're targeting the wrong branch of it, where the issue is that there's a whole lot of civil servants, but instead we're focusing on the perks of those at the top. And I think it just
Sorry,
it boils
can I
down
just
to
add?
the
Can I just add some numbers to that point? So Davy Ruat, the economist, actually quite
Yeah, please.
recently made the claim that the average civil servant, so not the top civil servant, the average civil servant earns 700,000 rand per year, which is, what, more than half of what an MP earns. And then he also said that altogether, excluding state-owned enterprises and local authorities, South Africa's 1.2 million civil servants. So, you look at that and you say, well, the average is earning kind of two-thirds of what an MP is earning. That's when you begin to see the scale of just how big the civil services are as a drain on the country's fiscus, not the 400 people in parliament, regardless of how useful one thinks that they may be. Sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. So because we can all agree that that is an issue and it's an issue that needs to be solved, it's a classic debate of which is the best way to bring about reform. Is it top down approach or is it a bottom up approach that we should be taking? And I'm presuming that your argument is the bottom up approach, but I believe that the top down approach would be just as effective because you would get in certain instances where some of these departments shouldn't even exist. Because obviously, if there would come a point where you'd have to scrap some positions, you'd get a lot of departments amalgamating into each other. Tourism can fall under international relations, and sports, arts, and culture can fall under social development, or so on and so forth. But there are other positions as well that don't even serve a purpose and aren't relevant enough. You have a Department of Women and Persons of Disabilities that's hiring a whole lot of civil servants as well. On top of that, South Africa can last a good week or two or more, definitely more, without that department existing. So that if we would ever begin the conversation of scrapping ministries, and if that process would begin, We would have to begin with the departments that don't serve any crucial role in South Africa, especially considering the position that we're in. Does it create a job? Does it create enough jobs? Does it tackle the poverty question? If it does not have a good outcome performance in terms of the issues we're currently facing, we can remove it and save a whole lot of money out of that.
So there's one more point, speaking on behalf of the devil here, that I may make the case of, and that is that, while nobody likes politicians really, that when you reduce the size of the executive like this, what you might end up doing is not actually reducing the number of civil servants. You'll have, in theory, it possible. This is a possibility, unless you also reduce the civil servants. You could end up in a universe where you have fewer politicians, fewer ministers watching over per minister, greater number of civil servants. And that can have consequences too, because that means that even if you have good ministers, you can have civil servants who then are essentially too numerous to keep track of, too, the system is too complex for the minister to manage effectively. And then the civil servants gain the power to do whatever they want, extract money through bribes, slow down reforms, favor their own political interests, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that's a thing we should worry about at all? And yeah, your thoughts on that defense.
To be able to offer a concrete counterpoint, I'd have to delve into the Constitution and what it says on that. Because, from my understanding, let's say they would scrap the Department of Women. They have a very nice big building in Pretoria, and there's people that work there. But if the department is scrapped, so you're not targeting the minister, you're targeting the department, then that means the director general and the DDGs below the director general and no longer existing. And everyone that works below them as well, the civil servants, those jobs would no longer exist. So that's my understanding of removing some of these cabinet positions. Not necessarily removing a minister, but you're removing a department.
Yeah, and I think that is a necessary sort of thing, because you can, have multiple departments under a minister, and in which case, you could end up in that situation. But interesting stuff. I don't think there's any feasible political road at the moment to especially do something as extreme as amend the Constitution. But it is, I think, important to center the debate on the size of South Africa's state, because our state is quite big, and at the same time does not provide particularly good value for money or services. If we had the Swedish or the Swiss state, you might be able to say, well, okay, yes, we spend a lot, but we get a lot from it. South Africa's state, not so much. Okay, speaking of the state not doing things super well, there's an article in Groundup, which is pretty worrying reading, where they went and looked at the state of essentially security of government websites across the whole of government. So this is following up on an article that they did relatively recently, where they looked at the State Information and Technology Agency's websites, of the 1,500-ish government websites in the country. 1,600, I think, is the number they give here. Two-thirds of them are run directly by the State Information Technology Agency, SITA, but you've got another sort of about 500 or so that are run outside of that ecosystem. And the ground-up investigators found, I think to the surprise of no one, that there are thousands of security flaws in these websites, which make them vulnerable to hijacking, to ransomware attacks, and to all sorts of other nefarious software intrusions. One in every five servers is vulnerable, according to the ground-up investigation. They say that we have now examined the government websites and services outside of SITA's network, using the same industry tool we use to look at SITA's network. These internet services are scattered across Telkom, Vodacom, MTN, Microsoft Azure, municipal servers, private hosting companies, and more. Some appear to be managed by government departments themselves. Some appear to have been built years ago by whoever was the cheapest or most expensive at the time, and not meaningfully touched since. They say that within the CETA network, the oldest unfixed security flaw dates back to 2006, 20 years ago. However, they also found that one of the non-CETA government websites has a has that there are 36 government systems with vulnerabilities that were first documented in 2007 and should have been patched out years ago if even basic maintenance was being done. So this basically means that it's very unlikely that these sites have had much maintenance done to them in about 20 years, which is kind of crazy. They say one of the worst examples is the Amatole District Municipality in the Eastern Cape. One of its servers hosted in a Microsoft data center carries over 353 known security vulnerabilities, of which 94 are rated critical. To give you a sense of how bad this is the reporter saying, CETA's entire network of more than 1,000 systems has 125 unique critical flaws in total. The municipality has managed to accumulate 75% of that on a single server. This draws our attention back to a story that was we actually talked about on the show last month, where Ekur Eleni revealed that billions had been stolen from the city because some hackers had gotten into the government's internal network through possibly one of these security vulnerabilities and simply assigned themselves as, you know, pay orders and just directed government money directly into their accounts, pretending to be sort of service providers for the city. Ofense, I've said this before, but I'm always amused by it, so I'll say it again. One of my favorite things about going to, I think it was the Gauteng provincial government website, is when clicking through the links, you see a wonderful banner that says, please place image here. And I think that pretty much sums up the state of government IT infrastructure.
Oh, no.
What are your thoughts on this story?
Yeah, so especially in our field of work, we visit government websites when we have to, you know, and then we see how poor they are. And then I remember this year, the first time I like visited a government website this year was when the war in Iran first broke out. And then I wrote an article on it of me venting about Derco's slow performance because every other country was bringing out these statements, these travel advisories, and they were doing so, even the most competent were doing so weeks before. At least 1 week before, because you could tell that something was brewing and an attack was imminent. So it was known that something was going to happen, and it's just governments communicating to their citizens. So when it came to South Africa, and we know there's a lot of South Africans in the Gulf region, especially in Dubai, when the attacks first broke out, we saw some attacks in those areas where there are South African citizens there. But the government took about a week to communicate to South African officials. But I didn't want to believe this. So on the day when it happened, I visited all the websites, all the embassy websites. The embassy websites are the worst things ever. I could vibe code a website by myself right now, and it would be 1,000 times better. And I don't know anything about programming. I'm so clueless with all that coding stuff. So the government has really been slipping on it. Technological prowess, especially with how easy it's becoming for the average Joe to use technology these days, like my example with the vibe coding, they can do that. And on top of that, in risk management, I typically speak of what I call 21st century political risks. So political risks before the 21st century were the typical expropriation or a coup or a dictator doing what dictators do best, so on and so forth. But now political risk looks a bit different because there's technology that's been involved. If someone has a clip of someone saying something that they shouldn't be saying, then that's a political risk to that person and their business. Another political risk is having a crappy website because you get not activists, but hacktivists, where hackers would come in to disturb or interrupt either your business or your government, in this case, for a political agenda, for a political reason. And we saw some of this in the past few weeks with the spring of these xenophobic, anti-immigrant rhetoric narrative attacks that have been happening in South Africa, that some government websites have been getting hacked by activists. And it's not a surprise. It's not a surprise because, as you told from this ground-up story, that we haven't been taking cybersecurity as serious as we ought to have been taking it. And also when looking at many, many polls that businesses have to fill in, usually at the end of the year, and then they get asked, what are your biggest concerns in terms of risk? Top one and top two and top three hovering up around there, it's always cybersecurity, cyber threats, because businesses face this a whole lot more than the South African government. The South African government is now facing it a lot. Are they going to take this political risk seriously, or does something very bad have to happen before they start taking it seriously?
No, it sometimes feels like our government is still operating as though it's 1995, and a website is just kind of a thing your cousin does for show, not a critical piece of infrastructure. And this is yet another reason why the South African state, in an age when we're seeing so many advances in biotechnology, AI, robotics, all these things. We still seem to be grappling with the appearance of the internet sometimes. There are apps some government departments have, but they also are not anything to write home about. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're also riddled with many security flaws.
I encourage anyone and everyone to visit the South African embassy in Abu Dhabi and Dubai website. It's actually quite embarrassing as a South African to look at that, at the website. It's empty, and the last news update would be like from 2018 or something like that. They don't take those stuff seriously.
And then there's that horrible feeling when sometimes you'll find a government website somewhere and a warning message will pop up when you go onto it that says, warning, needs Internet Explorer 4.3 or higher in order to run effectively. let's move on to our last story. And the Football Soccer World Cup is breaking out tonight, with the first game, I believe, being Mexico versus South Africa. So it's great to see that South Africa has qualified for the World Cup. This is the first World Cup we've been in since we hosted in 2010. And while, personally, I'm no soccer expert, so take this with a grain of salt, but I'm not expecting much. It's nice to just see the soccer team out there on the kind of international stage. I think as South Africans, we should just be happy to be there, quite frankly. That being said, we're going to talk a little bit about something kind of interesting that you had some thoughts on, and also, FIFA, a writer for the Daily Friend, Ivo Fechter, recently wrote an article for the Daily Friend titled FIFA, the World's Most Evil Monopoly. And it seems like FIFA is coming into some clashes with the U.S. government and its crackdown on immigration. So making headlines around the world, the U.S. has denied entry to a Somali referee, Omar Abdul Qadir Artan, for the World Cup. He would be the first Somali referee, I believe, in history to have been at the World Cup. And Somalia was looking forward to hailing him as a sort of, great evidence of national achievement. He was also Africa's Referee of the Year in 2025. But he was turned back by the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Service over the weekend. According to the customs agency in the U.S., they didn't give a lot of information. What they said was, quote, upon further inspection by CPB, derogatory information, including association with suspected members of terror organizations, was discovered. This was shared with reporters on condition of anonymity. So the CPB didn't want to kind of publicly get involved in this mess. FIFA has gotten involved in all of this, saying that you know, while they don't think Artan would be able to train or officiate the tournament, there were still diplomatic efforts and also by the Somali government behind the scenes to try and see if they can negotiate a way for him to enter the country. Somalia's government said it had unsuccessfully so far tried to negotiate with the US and FIFA, with their sports ministry saying his international achievements are a source of honor and pride for the Somali people. According to some media reporting, he had a valid visa, but all of this seems to coincide with an executive order signed by the Trump administration, which restricted travel from a number of countries around the world, including Somalia, to the United States. Now, Ofense, on one hand, this seems overly harsh. You know, this is not some obscure figure. This is a referee for a big tournament. I would imagine that it would be pretty easy to keep kind of tabs on him and what he's doing during the World Cup. So I struggle to kind of see him as being a security threat. But at the same time, and this is why I started talking about FIFA in the way I did, FIFA is a really dodgy organization. And yes, he doesn't work directly for FIFA and all that, but the world soccer infrastructure is one that is filled with all sorts of corruption and weird kind of stuff going on, and accusations of sports washing and all sorts of other nasty things. What do you make of this story?
Yeah. So firstly, I would say it's disappointing. It's disappointing that this whole thing is happening, mostly because the whole purpose of sport, let's even just start there, is to bring people together. The biggest rivals of two major cities will come together, have a few beers together, and watch a game of whatever sport is taking place. And the FIFA World Cup is meant to bring literally the world together. So if you're going to host the World Cup, it's quite important that you are an accommodating country. You know what you are hosting. You know what's going to take place, that many people from all over the world are going to come into the country to do what needs to be done, whether that's celebrating sports, whether that's being a referee. And so that's the disappointing part of it, that the whole purpose now is starting to crack because of politics. A second point is that Omar Artan is highly respected. He's highly respected in what he does. He even has a diplomatic passport. So he travels all around the world to do what he does best. And he won best African referee, or rather best referee in Africa. So he's good at what he does. He has the credibility and he does it all over the world. He's now not being allowed to do this at literally the biggest moment in his career, for the biggest stage in his industry, all because of politics again. And in terms of whether he has been talking to terrible organizations, like you mentioned, I didn't even think of that. But like you mentioned, it's quite easy to keep track of what he's up to because of what he's going there for. And because the fact that he has a special passport, there's a lot of steps he needs to go through to be viewed and seen to be put in the position that he's currently in. So it's very difficult for him to do anything that he's not supposed to do. On top of that, the whole Iranian team is already in North America now. I'm not sure where their base is, whether it's in Canada, US, or Mexico, but they're going to play the World Cup hosted by the US, and they were allowed in despite Iran being at a war with the US. A referee from Somalia, yeah, a sole person, is not being allowed to.
Can you imagine just for a second the tension and the excitement and the drama if the US and Iran end up facing each other in the World Cup? Oh boy, is that going to be quite something. That's going to be like North Korea versus South Korea. Probably worse.
And that's the beautiful thing about sport. Do you see this? And for those 90 minutes, the war wouldn't be the biggest story in terms of US-Iran. It would be who's going to score a goal first, or who's going to catch up, and this and that. So that's the whole point of sport, where all the politics is just shifted aside. Unfortunately, though, with FIFA. FIFA is political. Sports is political. Every single World Cup, there's always a certain scandal, from the 2010 one that happened here in South Africa, to Brazil, to Russia, to Qatar, and now this is the current scandal for this World Cup. It's just a few people not being allowed into the US. There are some journalists as well, football journalists, that were denied visas as well because of some connections they may have. And yeah, it's, people are being restricted from uniting, even though the objective is to unite people. And it's politics getting in the way. And it's disappointing. It's a whole big disappointing story. And hopefully it gets figured out and sorted out soon. Another point I just want to make quick. We also need to distinguish between FIFA and the US government, specifically the White House. So yes, FIFA can be shady and sketchy here and there, but the president of FIFA, Gianni Infantino, has a very solid relationship with President Trump. And Infantino wants the Somalian referee to get into the US, but he could not use his leverage over the US to get him inside the country and to avoid all this drama. So it shows that there's a bit of a disconnect, and there is some leverage that he does hold over the White House, because he awarded Trump the FIFA Peace Prize, and also he even co-signed the Board of Peace that President Trump started, and Infantino was there at the opening of the ceremony. So he's established this very close relationship with the US president, but that's where it ends. That relationship did not turn to leverage to try to make this FIFA project successful.
Okay. So in the pre-show discussion, Afensa, you asked me not to ask you for a prediction of what was going to happen at the Mexico-South Africa game tonight, but I'm going to completely ignore that and ask you for a prediction of what the score will be at the Mexico-South Africa game tonight. I'm going to be depressing and say we're going to lose 0-1, but I don't know, your thoughts.
It'll be 0-0. It's going to be a boring game. No one's going to score.
I hope that's not the case. I hope South Africa wins 3-0, and this is the beginning of our emergence onto the global football stage as the greatest dark horse contender in all of sports history. I'm not betting money on that. With that, thank you very much, everyone, for watching. We hope you found the show interesting. We will be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day.
The Daily Friend Show and the Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.